Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino, makers of Domino One, the cloud-based authoring tool for e-learning. Learn how your team can work together better at domino.com. That's DOMINKNOW.com. Now, here's this week's episode.
Oh, here we go. Here we go, everybody. Get ready. Yahoo! It's Wednesday morning, everybody. Good morning. And there's that bass line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Everybody got your dancing chairs on today?
Poof. Yeah, we do. But lots of weather in the chat today. Check it out. Man, people from all over.
Everybody's got weather today.
Funny how that happens.
I think we'd have a problem if you didn't have weather.
We didn't have the weather. We got the weather from all over the place. We have Texas in here. We got Philly. Where else do we have? London is even representing today. Floridians, Chicago, Atlanta. And we got a nice crew joining us today.
Yep. And thinking of the folks in Florida today as Hurricane Ian bears down on that area. Hurricane Fiona blew through the Canadian East Coast on the weekend. And although it wasn't... Anyway, lots of damage, as these kinds of storms always do. So thinking of the folks in Florida today, for sure.
Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. I got out of there just in time, apparently. So, Oh, South Africa, too. Wow. Hate to be all over the place this morning, but that just sort of took me by surprise. Welcome.
Hey, we're all over the place because our folks joining us in the session are all over the place. It's a domino effect. Ladies and gentlemen,
I love it.
Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino Learning Systems, which you all know that anyway. A non-intentional segue there, but anyway.
We're here every Wednesday. Tip your waitresses. Chris, great. We got a great guest today. Who's hanging out with us?
Folks, we have Jim Pachocki joining us for the first time. And since it's your first time, Jim, why don't you introduce yourself to the folks? Tell us your superhero backstory.
Okay. Well, I'm the Hollywood instructional designer, I guess, given the title, which means I came at this from the opposite direction of a lot of you. And I've been doing this for 20 years. I have Fortune 100 clients, but they call on me for a specific reason to clean up things that don't have that kind of sizzle or sting or whatever they want. So I'm rarely starting at the beginning of a project, but I come in to add learning gamification or in latest scenarios, virtual reality, blended solutions and things like that. So that's kind of where I'm from. I'm a fun guy. You
know? You're the fixer.
That's my
first movie reference. I figured we'd be tossing in a few today. So
that line in the film Species, where William Madsen comes in, or what his name is, and the girl asks him, what are you doing here? Catching this rabbit species. He goes, well, I don't know, but anytime you see me in the room, something seriously is messed up. You have to be expert at smoothing over egos because, unlike Hollywood, where everything is nepotism or just a script doctor fixing things there, the fixes in corporate aren't. It's quite blunt. So, I have a set of tools that I use to work with the writers that I've taken things over from. So, which is usually, it's 99% there. What are you talking about? Because people are afraid of losing their jobs when I walk in. Sure. So it's fun to, it's fun to give everybody happy.
Yeah. Mm. What part of the process do you typically come in on? I mean, not to, just jump right into the meat too quickly, but, is it script writing? Is it storyboarding? Is it the whole project that you have to kind of go over and reverse engineer what somebody else has done?
It's all of the above. It's whatever somebody decides seriously, seriously messed up. And hopefully sooner the better. I've had, I think at Amazon, my record is a one-day turnaround for an e-learning. And that was, 24 hours. So that's like, we had a saying. I worked for a company in Detroit called the Sandy Corporation, which was one of the inventors of industrial film called Jam Handy, had his work over to the Sandy, Bill Sandy of Sandy Corporation. And they had a slogan that's every day. I remember standing there, this guy from California came there. And the three guys were standing around, and the boss goes, I said, we got to turn this thing around in a day. And I said, well, you're talking about an 80-page script and all this stuff. And so he goes, oh, well, here in Sandy, we have a saying that every day is actually 3 8-hour shifts. And I thought he was joking. I looked around, and all the guys went, oh, yeah. So I've learned to work under, you know, and that's actually Hollywood type conditions are 15 to 18 hour days. And those people you see at Starbucks are on a break working on their screenplay and then going back to work. So it's like another country. It's like a third world country in some ways. But if you have a good
game. Well, that was going to be my next question too. So what, like, how, in your experience, how is the Hollywood production process maybe different from the instructional design or the e-learning process? And obviously it's huge, but I mean, like, just, you know, some of the little things
I'm nowhere to be found in any of these databases like IMDb and everything, because I was a script doctor, which means due to the nepotism in the industry, somebody's cousin or nephew wrote the script, and you're always brought in to fix it with a very hush-hush kind of things. Even the Writers Guild doesn't have a category. Well, they do, but it's not really acknowledged. So the big difference is the director calls all the shots in L.A. You are working for, I guess the most famous director I worked for was Ridley Scott, working on some commercials. I started as a copywriter at Ruben Poster, which is Honda's advertising agency, and then moved into the training world, kind of blended into there. And so, you know, they have ultimate power, you know, over any of this stuff, especially in commercials where the director's off of the shooter as well, like Joe Pitka, people like that. So, yeah, so there's that. And then the biggest other difference is just the hours. I mean, I was just conditioned. I saw people leaving at 5. My first staff job, and I'm like, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "We're going home." I said, "Oh, great!" that's when you have lunch usually in production or try.
Typically, it doesn't work like that. Yeah, Chris, you've done Hollywood work, right?
I had a previous career. No, I haven't. I'm even stumped for a really sarcastic, stupid thing to throw in there. So,
only thing that comes to my mind, Chris, is I'll bet you've worked with some directors where there's only one person who gets to call all the shots, right?
You know, I actually do have an acting credit. I was in a CBC production when I was in high school that ran. In fact, it ran twice. So I actually got a residual check out of that once. But that was... A much smaller production than a Hollywood production, for sure.
Hey, company, you got to check. That's important.
Our company, Idealab Production, Idealab Creative, did really well because we found a niche for ourselves there, which is between the ad agencies and all my buddies that went to from film school to making features who we employed in their off time. And so we made long form documentaries. Remember the magazines with that? Check here if you want to get the new Nissan Maxima and learn more about it. Before the internet, there were documentaries you would order and get a DVD. Those are highly produced. So most of them just use dealer running footage, stock footage. But we actually, that's where we created stories. We met with the engineers. We made real documentaries or we did dramatizations. And that's what I'd studied kind of in school. And that was kind of my transition from filmmaking to training making. And I studied with a guy named Miguel Sabido. He taught me the Sabido methodology, which ensures that drama turns into behavior change. And he did that with telenovelas in Mexico. He didn't speak English, and we had to bring him in and have a translator for the class. But what his job at Televisa was is to produce learning dramas. And he reduced the population of Mexico growth by like half. He got women, a record number of women, to open their own businesses for the from the series Simple Simplemente Maria. So that's what I really got jazzed about is what all I learned. I mean, I studied at USC Film School. You study with the masters, and I learned how to draw out good interviews from amateur talent, from documentary guys like Ben Shedd. My camera teacher was Caleb Deschanel. He shot The Black Stallion. And so all this stuff, Ed Burt, who edited Apocalypse Now on editing. So you learn from these guys, and they don't tell you anything. You have to draw it out of these 6-hour workshops. And so I was just really jazzed when I realized I could teach some people things, because I love teaching. In my 20s, I did that when I couldn't get a job. And but I also love filmmaking, so it kind of brought together the both. And really, the training person in a lot of companies is like we're the first to go and the last to be hired back. I mean, learning is not on the corporate ladder, it's finance, right?
Yeah, it's brutal.
There's a reason for that, but I mean, you know, yeah. I used to think I was, hot stuff. And then I realized I was missing the point, that there are people that are excited about these projects. And, just the fact that where I was from means nothing to them. It's like one guy told me once, I mentioned a name, and he goes, "Oh, is that a name you just dropped?" I was doing that. So I did this. What purged me of my LA is I moved to Detroit, where everybody does everything, a lot of different hats, and everybody's fun and nice. And somebody comes up to you in LA and says, "Hey, didn't you work for so-and-so?" It means they want something. Whereas in Detroit, they say, "Hey, how are you doing today?" They're really asking you, "How are you doing?" They don't want anything.
Yeah, Detroit will definitely purge LA from your system, I believe.
The weather, too. First day I got there, like, skies are black, speaking of the weather. I'm in my desk, and I look up, and I got it, and I drove home. I thought, we're having a tornado, and it was just weather.
Yeah. Hey, let me throw out a question to the chat real quick here. How many of you folks in the chat actually come from kind of the creative side of the world too? We always talk about on Idiotic, we got, teachers that are coming into instructional design and whatnot. And lots of folks, I mean, I would probably say 99% of people that get into instructional design or corporate training kind of stumble into it from some strange angle. And it sounds like the same thing for you, Jim. But how many of you folks specifically, if any, have come from sort of that? I only say Hollywood just because it kind of is a nice broad word to mean the video, film, kind of production side of the world. I'd be curious to see. Or maybe any of you that are doing this kind of stuff is part of your instructional design. It'd be cool to see what's who we got hanging out with us today.
Well, Buddy's got a BFA in sculpture and art education. Very cool. Yeah, Renee's mentioning graphic designer, art director as a previous career. Jennifer, holy touring Celtic singer. There's hundreds of dollars to be made in folk music. Sometimes not even hundreds. I know. Yeah, JDW visual arts background. Shannon says ranch to bartender to elementary teacher to corporate to instructional designer. That's a route.
I love that. Where was your ranch, Shannon, if you don't mind me asking? Media e-learning designer for 30 plus years. Dr. Rose, welcome.
Michelle, a licensed customs broker, and then into this space. Not even close. That's a heck of a leap. Yep, for sure.
Very cool. Well, that helps us a little bit, kind of, spur some creative juices in the conversation. You mentioned one particular project you were on, or at least connected to, the guy in Mexico. I love those kinds of stories, though. Was there any others or one in particular that kind of made you believe that, oh, you know what? moving into this whole corporate thing might be a little more lucrative than hanging out in Hollywood.
Well, actually, my first job was kind of a cushy one. And that was, my student films had won some awards and had made a lot of friends in the faculty. And so I got a job through a referral on a TV show in the 80s called He-Man and the Masters of the Universe and She-Ra, Princess of Power. So, in fact, we worked for Filmation Studios in Reseda, California, where that Boogie Nights film was shot, kind of in that kind of an area, you know, kind of semi-corporate, rundown, small entertainment businesses. And I always remember trying to get She-Ra made, because we said, He-Man's got to have a sister. My mom was a singer, bodybuilder, and strong woman, three strong sisters. And we went into the story editor, and he said, He-Man's sister, girls don't want superheroes. Girls want easy bake ovens and Barbies, because our sponsor was Mattel. So we need to sell more Barbies. Come up with something like that. We thought that was an idiot, you know, just totally out of it. You know, this guy had directed Elvis films. That was his last credit. Mm-hmm. Animation is similar to learning in that it was a kind of a last career for a lot of people, or a dumping ground for a lot of people from different areas. Not that learning is a dumping ground, but that was. So luckily, Lou Scheimer, the studio's owner, his daughter was a avid softball fan, and she loved the idea of She-Ra. We had done a previous TV show called Isis, which was a crappy Saturday cartoon. That was before I came on, or not a cartoon, but live action with, I think it was Linda Carter or somebody like that. So that sort of stuff, you know, I thought, you know, it was seasonal. It was, we were always being laid off, you know, and possibly hired back. So I thought, well, let's go for something more regular. And this guy, so I'd gone back to graduate school and studied health and behavior change at the USC Annenberg School for Communication. And where we met Sabido and a bunch of other experts who taught us a lot of stuff about mind control and other things that I would have thought was total fascism when I was in film school. So, but I started to get into it. I like on He-Man working with the broadcast standards, with the censor. You know, and learning how to, because every He-Man, my job is to create the learning message that Loki, this character, brought into the picture. So, as well as write 9 episodes per season. So, to get to the point, I got a call from this guy in Detroit, and he basically kind of talked me into being out there. And then I was in the middle of learning, and I was applying all the stuff that I learned. If you write the wrong script for a suicide prevention center, person at the other end line could offer. So you basically.
So I'm, yeah, you don't want to make a mistake on that gig.
Right. Fix it. Asterisk. No, but. So specifically, what was your question? I'm trying to answer it accurately, but I.
No, I was just curious. What made you decide to finally say being in the corporate space is definitely where I want to put 100% of my time, right? Like when you made that transition, you know, was there, I mean, maybe it was a whole bunch of different things that kind of slowly moved you there, but I was just thinking maybe there was one moment where you just kind of went, you know, I'm going to go ahead and stick with this corporate gig.
I guess, yes, there was. When I was brought in, I was the guy from California, and that means you're some sort of hot stuff. Which I wasn't. I was just out of grad school, and I had a lot of theories about learning, not applied. But I was creative. I was used to going in the room and somebody saying, a guy walks into a bar with a duck. What's the punchline? You know, and coming up with funny stuff. In fact, if anyone has a good punchline, that might be good. But but anyway, there is one, but I forgot it. So they were being bombarded by New York competition. One of them finally connected with their Chevrolet client for a big corporate movie called a dealer launch film. And if you've been in the car business, that's when the door opens. Dip your hand in the gold river, right? So otherwise they're just as cheap as everybody else. So we had been launching this new series of cars called the Corsica and Beretta, which tells you how old I am, and the L car. And so what they did is they were panicking because it turns out their proposal was thrown out by their client And this other company in New York, Jack Morton, was going to score. So they brought me in to fix it. And so I said, well, you know, I didn't know how many resources these companies had. But I said, okay, so what do you want to do? What, it was, oh, come, we can put some midgets in there and we can do this. A lot of dumb ideas, you know, from people that don't create for a living. In the sense that the LA is very specific. So I said, well, let's just do moonlighting. I said, I know the agent for this young guy, Bruce Willis, and we can get Cybill Shepherd, and let's write a moonlighting episode. And that was a hot series. And no one had ever said.
I remember that.
Remember moonlighting? Yeah, it was really good.
Oh, heck yeah.
So that's what they pitched, which they, and I said, that put Chuck Yeager in it, had him flying the spaceship, and then driving the Chevrolet around. And but let's do a drama. Let's do something where these characters make sense. And then we'll work in the message. You don't even have to say you're there. Just the fact that you're sponsoring it, then have a dealer message at the end. So he said, oh, well, no, let's, okay, do that. So we did that. And so we walked in the room. We sold the idea. It was eventually changed to Ted Bissell and Kathy Lee Crosby. Ted Bissell was the boyfriend and that girl. Kathy Lee Crosby was this girl, woman in the gold lame dress. So, but we'd sold it. And this is what told me where I was. The account executive turns to the sales guy, turns to the client and says, how much budget do you have? He goes, I've got about $1,000. And I said, what? I mean, I just kept my mouth shut and I left him. I said, hey, Mike, you must have like a lot of hidden money somewhere, something to do. He goes, oh, no, a buck in Detroit terms is $1,000. So we had just sold a $1 million industrial film, which films used to cost a lot more.
Yeah.
And that convinced me that, hey, there's something we could do here. We could get John Whitney Jr. and do some serious computer animation. Or we could, we had budgets, we'd do things. And so being semi-practical about that kind of got me to stay there. You know, it was...
Yeah, and it's still exercising your creativity. You know, you're still having fun even in doing that with the that different context. Yeah, very cool.
How is it? Let's get into a little bit on working with instructional designers. So, you know, how do you find that? And you know, do you consider yourself an instructional designer? Right, all of the things dealing with training departments. Right, as a Hollywood guy, it was probably a little bit. It was probably new to you walking into a corporate space and having this training department try to tell you, you know, how to make educational content and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But, you know,
I remember once in, we walked in with, we wanted to do something with mimes. This kind of answers your question with an anecdote, and then I'll get to the meat of what you're asking about, because it's a really great question. We did a piece on ergonomics, office ergonomics, which is how to avoid stress and strains and other kinds of things, and how to sit upright. If you move your arm, if you don't have a right angle on your arm when you're typing, you will get RMIs eventually. So there's all these little things. So we did it with mimes. And we took out all the voiceover, because that's my big thing is I'm a bit influenced by this book. It's a great book. PowerPoint Doesn't Suck, You Do.
Oh, that's my kind of book. I got to get that.
He's my former writing partner, and he basically says, get rid of the bullets, get rid of the PowerPoints. Don't even do a PowerPoint until the very end. Talk it through, right? Bubbles, a little for yourself. Talk it through. You know, whereas a lot of us as instructional designers feel we have to fill up the page with bullets. And by the end of the, you look at people asleep. So, what I did is to tell me the beginning of the story. I forgot. I got lost on David again. What was your?
Just how do you engage with the instructional designers and all that stuff? Yeah.
We had worked together with a team of people, including copywriters and instructional designer, everything else. And we went in to show it to the boss who hadn't seen it yet. And there was this big bang when he threw something down. He says, "What is that, guys? Dressed up like a, you know," he used the word we can't use anymore. And he said, and he goes, "Those are mimes." He goes, "Mimes? What are you putting mimes in my industrial film? He looks like a, you know," So we learned early on that the greatest instructional design might not resonate with clients. And so I guess that's where I'm kind of coming from is, the way I work is I try to, because I worked as a lead ID and a learning and Amazon and L&D manager, kind of a role I created for myself. And so I worked with other instructional designers, and I think a lot of them come from different backgrounds. So I try to find out, is this a school teacher instructional designer? Sorry. Is this the brochure guy that got bumped up into the learning department? Or is this someone who's really passionate about what they're trying to kind of create? And so, and what I love is the newer schools that are coming out now with instructional technology degrees, where you have kids coming out, and some older people coming out with a detailed understanding of technology and a more of an open mind and trying to understand the field and how to apply it. So, yeah, I mean, first thing's got to go is any objectives. Those come out. Because everybody, those belong in the design document, not in the training. Why would you want to sit through somebody says, by the end of this thing, you'll be learning five things. Well, you don't know what anybody is in the room. So you don't know what their WIFMs are and everything. So those come out. And
I was going to say, you better clarify that statement or else you're going to fire up a lot of people in the chat and say, what do you mean no objectives?
There are objectives.
Right.
In the design document, there's no room for them in my learning because then it becomes a corporate piece. Okay. The seminal turning point in my career was when I was sent by Honda to where I was on staff as their training writer by Ruben Pastor, their ad agency, had a 20-person training department. They sent me to Providence to sit in a class that I was going to adapt into a PowerPoint at the time. And I think they had an automated version of PowerPoint, like a laser disc or something that they were going to do. And I heard two consultants said to each other, or two salespeople, because it was sales training. The trainer says, hey, he says, is this any good? He goes, it's another week of your life you'll never get back. And I don't want that. I want to destroy, to mutilate, to strangle, to kill anything that smacks of this kind of corporate poetry or boringness. And I think, or whatever the word is for. So I try to start in medias res, which is an Aristotelian term. It means you kind of start in the middle of things. The vignette starts after all the exposition happens. You know, you learn this in writing. There's no room for anybody who's trying to write all this. We used to call it Exposition Boulevard, because that's the street that runs along USC. Figaro and Exposition. You take that out, okay, and start in the middle of something, and then you can circle back to there. Of course, there are objectives, but the objectives are operationalized inside the drama or inside the slideshow, inside the iconography you've created, whatever. But I mean, you have to kind of get people's attention. And every 3 minutes, I have a 30-second rule in e-learning. No slide longer than 30 seconds. And the 3-second rule is also something has to change every 3 seconds, you know, like a bullet or a small text bullet or a visual or something that moves, you know. And with today's technologies and the amount of stock available, this is something IT kids from instructional technology get, and what anyone can learn. You can do that. You can make things move. But establishing rules like that, I think, or not rules, but policy, what's the word?
It's a guideline.
Guideline.
I always like the phrase, it's more of a guideline than a rule.
Yeah. Like my dad said, we have a heuristic at this table, not an algorithm. You know, at dinner, my dad was a math guy who worked on the Saturn V rocket. He was brought in when the thing was blowing up, and they couldn't get it off the tarmac, you know, the launch pad.
So you come from a family of fixers.
Fixers, yes. Polish, humble Polish people who like to fix the farm tools and use bad words. I like to keep it friendly and you know, if somebody is really adamant, I've had people walk out, right, you know, I'm not gonna do this, or I've been called hard to work with by clients, you know, so I pick those battles very carefully, because I'll always ask, and I recommend anyone trying this approach, don't try it cold. You have to do what my professor Bob Cialdini said. He wrote a book called Influence, The Science of the Psychology of Persuasion, which is a great book. I should write that in. But
I'll drop it in for you.
Oh, thank you. Influenced by Cialdini.
I've read it. It's a good one.
Okay. Thank you so much. So Bob always said that, and we became friends, I used to hire him on a lot of shows, and he's one of our advisors on my new company, LightVal. Plug, plug, pitch, pitch. No. And but he and Sabito are advisors on my company, LightVal Learning, that we've developed. I've spent 20 years putting this thing together. That's all I'll say. So in any case, lightvalvelearning.com. But in any case, you have to persuade by finding out where they go to church, what church they go, temple or church they go to, who is their kids, where they go to lunch, all that stuff, and just show up there, just be there. Read the 48 Laws of Power if you really want to get some tips on how to secure clients, or find out what they are. Hey, Jim, what are you doing here? And I don't commit sacrilege or take the sacraments when I'm not doing faith work. But that would go to hell, right? What my mother would say. But Irish Catholic mother. So, but find out all you can about these clients before you do anything wild like that. But luckily, I've been attracting the wilder clients. So I just got fired from Microsoft, though, because I was too hard to work with. But that was a contract. So, I mean, and it was a screwy deal. It really was.
Yeah.
But anyway, everybody does that, and you have to be ready to get fired, too, because, or at least not asked back as a contractor. Nobody is fired.
And Chris, I know your mind is spinning on all of this. What's going through your head?
Well, Jim, you had suggested in the green room that that you had some things that you might want to share with us to, you know, give some examples of some of the things. And Sobia is asking a similar question. She's more focused on the something with the 30-second rule and the 3-second visual change as an example. But I think there's a lot of folks who would love to see a little bit of something in action if you're able to do that.
I can send a link they can follow. This is a piece we did for the U.S. Postal Service, which is called Don't Plug In. Of course, we had all the philosophers telling us there's a cybersecurity gig and a three-year salary job, actually, that I left. What this did is it helped. The Postal Service got hacked in 2014, and millions of names were gone, cut, umpteen, who knows how much money. That's the things they never know. And if the thing is still in there. So they hired us to help their contractor to, and I was the instructional designer, lead ID. It was a small group. So we didn't really have technically a lead idea, but I was the most experienced. So we wanted to create, they needed something, okay? And they had not thought this thing through. So I said, well, you guys need a tent pole. You know, that's something to hang all your training and all your other things on. So let's do that. Now, the company I'd worked for was a defense contractor with Emmy, and the way it works in Washington is all the defense companies recruit from Discovery, the channel. And they basically win your Emmys and you get a contract up, you move up to doing stuff. So we had Emmy Award winning camera guy, producers, an original score, a great team to make music. So we said, let's pull the stops out and show a hack. Put people through the experience of a thumb drive hack, which was when someone gives you a thumb drive, don't ever take it because you have, that was my wife, don't ever take it because there's malware on it. And so we'd show this idiot doing that. And it was done at a production value that was unheard of at the time. Well, it was there. I mean, but they were selling missiles with it. That's what they sell, a missile or a bomb or an airplane. They would put on a big show for the government. It's like that film with Nicolas Cage, right, where they've got things going on. But it's done in media now.
Yeah.
So, and that's where I got into VR, because they had brought me there also because of my, I had done the first VR and in the 90s, one of the first ones. In fact, Palmer Luckey, the inventor of the Oculus, was our PA. So he was smart enough to take the algorithms and build the the Oculus Rift, which is now dominant in the marketplace. And so we had done, so that's kind of an example of what you can do. You can look at it 3 minutes long.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for dropping that in there. You know, we've got a little bit of time left, but yeah, I totally forgot that we were going to talk about virtual reality and all that kind of stuff, but maybe you could just give us a quick, how do you apply these same kinds of thoughts and ideas into the VR space? You know, I know, because since it's interactive and someone's supposed to be in there, you're not really scripting it or, you know, really defining it. It's more of an open play type area, right? Or do you still need to kind of apply the same Hollywood, you know, processes?
Well, I think what you're talking about is augmented reality, where you're looking through the glasses and can see the room. And like IKEA has that app where you can order furniture and then put it in your living room.
Yeah.
That's not what we do.
Okay.
We do our virtual reality because on the headsets I'll simulate with these cut out everything else. These hyper focus you. Right. Whereas you and I are now thinking about 10 different things, and anybody in the room is thinking 5 or 10 different things. I think, how's this guy gonna edit? He's got a big nose, or you know, whatever. And I'm thinking of one thing when I'm in those headsets. So it keeps you focused. Plus, well, we developed a new format that I built in LA using 3D stereoscopic. Because if you think about it, most VR that you look at is flat. You know, when we're doing live action, we don't do cartoons. Those, I call them a cartoon, those avatars. You know, that's for a lower end of production. We're shooting for soft skills training, for things like that. So we use VR for learning purposes. In this case, they had a problem with factory injuries, you know, people blowing themselves up, people not wearing the right PPE, gouging their eyes out, so like that. And we had all the safety data. So we developed, with a DLA, we developed, there are 4 levels of measurement in the learning world, from 1 reaction all the way through level 4, and the Kirkpatrick scale, which is return on investment or injury reduction, things like that, insurance premiums going down, things like that to help the workers. So we developed a level 4 evaluation of the amount of injuries we saved and we stopped, the amount of insurance premiums we cut using the University of Washington. Think about level 4 is it costs 60% of your budget. But we had a government grant procurement for $780,000. And I said, guys, let's make this look like $10 million. Let's do this for the workers, you know, because my dad was seriously wounded in an industrial accident that kind of ended his career. So it just brought back all this trigger, all these things that I grew up with. So I talked people into doing that. We had built our own equipment in LA. There are no stereo VR cameras. There's one, but it's kind of a 180 camera. There's no stereo cameras. So we built our own equipment. So I'd hired the same crew and brought them in. We filmed it. We thought, hey, we'll reduce injuries 20%, 30%. That'd be great. They went down 72% in the first year and continued to spike lower 70%, 75% in year 3. So that was unheard of. Run the data again. That's impossible. You know, the data's there. But the data comes in weird. You have to collate it and run it again.
Sure.
Run it again. Came out the same. So, that became my life's work for me to really continue to diffuse VR. We made the Patriot missile function again. And then we created the V-22 Osprey was having some problems. And we used a VR solution to get rid of the $10 million simulator they were using and put it in a little box with 8 HTCs. And all the stuff goes on a plane and gets deployed somewhere. I don't see where it goes. And we don't have to break the tools or anything or the dies. But we created a powerful tool. And that's why Raytheon encouraged me to bring it to the private sector, you know, to help people like our new Amazon plant. Amazon has 1/2 of the industrial accidents in the world occur at an Amazon center. That's OSHA data released by the Guardian, you know, they're big advocates. So
We'll have to cut that out later, everybody. We don't want to be demonetized. No, we don't monetize. I'm just.
No, we love Amazon. No.
I'm just joking with you, Jim. It's okay. We're all good.
but you notice that what you bring up is very important. Be aware of yourself politically as an instructional designer in what you recommend, because sometimes the reason training looks screwy, it's got one shot that lasts all along, it's because one of the senior VPs has dyslexia. I don't know. It's because there's always a reason why things are screwed up. So yeah. Unlike William Madsen, you're not there to fix things because they're screwed up. You need to be using your active listening to find out where these are. And like you say, if I come in later in the process, when the cattle is there, but if the hat is bad, you know, the Texas here, he's all hat and no cattle. So often it's the opposite on the East Coast. It's with the West Coast is all hat and no cattle. East Coast is all brilliant strategies, brilliant marketing, brilliant training philosophies and anger and all this stuff. Whereas the hat is boring, they're bad. So you have to kind of, that's the thing I like, but I love fixing things the most. And here's kind of something for instructional designers to learn from, I guess. If you do a good job and you're good at your job and you crank out a piece that, or develop a piece you're passionate about and the client loves it, that's one thing. But if you come in and fix another person's bad work, then they know how valuable you are as an instructional designer. And that elevates, you know, your status. But then this field, there's no JD or there's no, not until recently, there isn't like a credential. I'm ATD certified, and their CPLP is very demanding. And I encourage people to try it. But the tip on CPLP, make sure you have a measurement that's level 3 or higher, because you're going to get, they don't accept evaluations. One of my friends got kicked out, and because you spend $1,300 or something on this thing, but they're very picky. They don't pick anybody, just anybody. So make sure that your level 3 or level 4 example is in there in the samples that you share. So anyway, but that's
perfect. That's kind of... Chris, I'll give you the last question. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, I just wanted to know a little bit more about that VR project with the safety, with the, 75%. Tell us a little bit about what people experienced in that. Just, you know, briefly, I'm trying to picture that in my mind. How, you know, what were they doing in that VR?
It's not anything you'd imagine, but it is pure Sibido. The Sibido method asks you to go into the peer community and become part of that community. That's how we went into the Yaqui Indians, or went into the homes of the battered women in Mexico, or the men who refused to use birth control, you know, that sort of thing. And you have to find out, you have to live with them. And there's a whole checklist that I've kind of adapted from that. So what I found out, because it has to be diagnosed specifically, that's what makes diagnostics is what makes the good people good. A great car mechanic, for example, will hear a sound and be able to tell what it means. Whereas another guy will just read the manual and say, oh, I don't know. So which is why I always take my car to the Honda dealer, you know, the Acura dealer in this case, because they know their stuff and they saved us money long term. Anyway, they were missing mindfulness. They had all the safety training you could imagine. I mean, you know, government doesn't, you know, and they have to pay people for the training as well. So I'd done this before for another logistics agency, and I said, you know, we can get this thing down to a half an hour. And they're like, why? Can you have to have at least a day, you know? Who's is that written down somewhere? So I showed them my notes and my results and the things that I had planned in my wireframe for doing this, because you don't want to go into production until somebody's signed off on the milestone. And they got it. They agreed. So what we did is we created a drama between this character named TJ, okay, and this other character who was the safety instructor, and another character who was completely lost safety-wise and couldn't give a crap. But you had to sympathize with, because we're going to kill him at the end. And so got to kill your babies, they say at USC. So we had a drama, and so we had a transitional character in the middle, which is what the method prescribes as having someone on the fence. So I just took it and I made it, you know, I wrote the script and I directed the piece, and it came out, and it when I run you over with a forklift, and I'm trying to think, I guess TJ was the bad guy, and Hakeem was the good guy that was on the fence. And when you run over TJ, because he steps outside the line, the whole room, of course, their heads snap back like that, wearing the headsets. And I think because of that, no one would believe it. You can't do a drama. I said, well, wait a minute. What about the ancient Greeks? Have you read the Odyssey? Have you read, the frogs or anything like that? Those were all teaching myths, all mythologies were there to teach respect for the gods. And we were just pivoting in this case. This is what Sabino taught me, by teaching safety insurance.
Gotta love it, but we're probably gonna have to save it for the next time because we have we've gone over, but that's okay. What a great conversation today, Jim. Thank you so much for hanging out.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this was so fabulous. As always, thanks to everybody who's been providing thoughts as we went along in the chat as well.
Great chat today.
A couple of quick announcements. We actually have an Idiotic booth coming up at the DevLearn event in Vegas at the end of October, about a month away. We'll have more info about that in next week's episode, but some neat stuff there, and we welcome you to drop by. Brent will be there. I'm actually not going to make it to DevLearn to do this, but as part of our Domino booth, we have the Idiotic portion of things actually is being represented there. So
tons also, of fun.
Brent's got the LinkedIn group. Brent's got the LinkedIn group posted there. Make sure you join us there too, folks, for more updates and more info. Yeah.
Indeed. And as always, who brings this Idiotic, Chris?
Oh, really? I completely forgot that part. That's because I got it out of the way at the beginning. Folks, Idiotic is sponsored by Domino Learning Systems, makers of Domino One. You might be interested in some of the ways that we can help you and your team make better things for e-learning, m-learning, other learning, and more. There's a link there to check out.
All that good stuff. Yep, indeed. Thanks again, Jim. Appreciate everything you've shared with us. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Thank you.